Hello, audio journal listeners. In place of our regularly scheduled programming, we bring you the following program brought to you by Audio Journal.
Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. Beginning today with Marie Claire. Do you need to check into an adult summer camp? Yearning for simpler times, adults are collecting fluffy toys and rediscovering high school hobbies. One writer reclaims her youth at a summer camp for grown-ups. By Catherine Madden. Balancing my plate, glass, and cutlery with the grace of a rookie waiter, I walk into breakfast and scan the space for somewhere to sit. Every table is full. Chatter and laughter resonating around me, and suddenly I'm back at school camp in a retro Australian seaside town. I'm in grade 7, the year my friends were all split into different weeks, and mealtimes at long communal tables fill me with angst. I start hatching a plan to back away slowly and feign a mysterious stomach bug, or maybe melt into the floor like a drizzle of maple syrup when, "Catherine, over here!" A woman with kind eyes and an American accent snaps me out of my daydream, gesturing toward her table and briskly rearranging the seats to squeeze me in. Grateful, I walk over and put down my plate, which is piled with golden baguette, wedges of soft cheese, and freshly picked apricots, and nary a spoonful of sludgy, syrup-topped porridge in sight. Toto, I have a feeling we're not at school camp anymore. Instead, I'm at Camp Chateau, a summer camp for women in the countryside of southwest France. Each week, some 50 women from across the world descend on a 13th century chateau in the Quercy region and spend their days crafting, kayaking, and bonding under the glorious Gallic sun. Nights are like teenage sleepovers in shared rooms, albeit charming ones, decked out in time-worn antiques and with shuttered windows that open onto views of the honey-hued hills. As an Australian, the concept of summer camp is as elusive as it is romantic, the stuff of girlhood in motion, a la The Parent Trap or The Babysitter's Club. But the desire to reconnect with one's inner child feels universal right now. How else do you explain the parents feverishly collecting monster-faced labubus, or the rise of school excursions for adults via clubs and communities? Nostalgic hobbies are resurging: crochet, pottery, papercraft. And new studies suggest play is as fundamental to an adult's livelihood as good nutrition and sleep. In a world of overwhelm, the case for being a kidult is strong. Camp Chateau was the brainchild of British-born, U.S.-based Philippa Gerling, a former top-level banking executive. Her best friend, Linda Coleman, and Gerling's daughter, Leah Likens. Their vision was to create a place where women and people who identify as women could just be. We didn't want it to feel like a corporate off-site. No forced fun, obligations, or expectations, says girling, adds lichens, and it's not a self-development retreat. Self-development is actually work, right? For women, there are really limited spaces where you don't have any requirements other than to just play. You're not tasked with self-improvement or any kind of remarkable, perfect adventure. With that in mind, I made my way to the elective's sign-up sheet and scribbled my name next to jam making. Given I have no aspirations to be the next Nara Smith or Meghan Markle, it seems suitably removed from personal growth. Though I wonder how they would fare in the inhibition-busting warm-up activity led by a bubbly camp counselor who has us step-clapping in a circle, chanting, "What's my jam?" We go on to make apricot confiture using tangy orange fruits plucked straight from the trees and later spread it on buttery croissants. We eat picnic style on the ground that's bursting with daisies and dahlias, which we'll later forage for and turn into flower crowns. And so the cycle of camp life goes. Over the week, opportunities abound for goofiness and good, wholesome fun. There's a silent disco under the stars, which sees a circle of women aged somewhere between 20 and 80 dancing with wild abandon to Pink Pony Club, and girls just want to have fun. The mood in the air is akin to that of a Taylor Swift concert. Glittery, joyful, cringy in a good way. I've had men say to me, "We should create something like this for men," says Girling, who spent her banking career persevering through patriarchal barriers. And I say to them, "Absolutely you can. Nothing's stopping you." Chimes in Coleman, "The world is their camp." In the warm bubble of the chateau, I notice that conversations between women feel different. Defining topics in the outside world, namely careers and men, seem to slip to the side. We don't really ask people what they do for work. The kind-eyed American, a return camper, advised me on my first day. Later, I find out she's a high-flying international marketing consultant. Another camper works for Planned Parenthood, and a few have risen through the ranks of Wall Street. But those are probably the least interesting things about these women. Instead, we talk about romantasy novels and Saturn returns, ADHD diagnoses and divorce, wanting to have kids, not wanting to have kids, past adventures, and plans to return and reunite, like any good summer camp. Perhaps the beauty of cosplaying as a kid is not just in eschewing responsibilities and chasing wonder, but in reconnecting who we were before jobs, partners, and families of our own shaped us. One camper shares that on the last day of the week, she looked in the mirror and saw herself for the first time in years. We didn't intend for the camp to become a transformative experience, says Girling. Women are already awesome. They don't need to work on themselves. They need space and a break. The camp is for them to see themselves and love what they see. It doesn't necessarily require a big journey. It just happens. It's actually in you. All you need is space and badges. I collect 15 Girl Guide style badges during my stay. They're handed out each evening in a peppy, all-American ceremony that feels like I've been plonked into one of those U.S. tween movies. There's one for watercolor painting, for jam making, and for wine tasting, for film night and taking a nap. My favorite is for body movement. The elective takes place in a sunlit castle garret, and only 5 of us turn up. We're taken through a series of interpretive dance exercises, undulating our bodies like swaying trees and cats tiptoeing on the creaky floorboards, stifling giggles whenever we catch one another's eyes. Suddenly, again, I'm an awkward teenager, not looking for a place to sit, but frolicking about playfully, laughing uncontrollably in drama class. And this time, it feels really good. From House Beautiful, Swedish death cleaning is the decluttering method everyone's suddenly talking about, by Kate McGregor. Swedish death cleaning isn't quite as morbid as the name suggests. The process involves decluttering and organizing your belongings so that when you pass, your loved ones won't have to wade through piles of knickknacks and 30-year-old paperwork. Still, not an overall joyful notion, but thoughtful nonetheless. Think of it as more heavy duty than spring cleaning, but less intense than a full-on Marie Kondo moment. An age-old concept in Sweden and throughout Scandinavia, the concept most recently became buzzy stateside when the TV show The Gentle Art of Swedish Death Cleaning hit streaming platform Peacock in 2023. It's no surprise the show was a hit. After all, we've looked to the Nordic countries for functional designs and relaxation ideas for ages. No matter what stage of life you're in, Swedish death cleaning is a considerable concept. So, if you're eager to know more, for now or in the future, we've highlighted the 7 pillars of the cleaning process here. Swedish death cleaning basics. The basic definition of Swedish death cleaning is the process in which a person cleans out their belongings and sets their affairs in order in anticipation of their death. Rather than leave your loved ones to sort through a closet of sweaters you haven't worn in years, or shelves full of books you've already read, why not make their lives easier by doing the hard work for them? Things you still need to live happily or want to pass on, such as extra supplies for your favorite hobby or family photo albums, are exempt. What areas should you focus on? The short answer, all of them. The long answer, begin with the area that's easiest to tackle and work towards the most overwhelming one. Author Margareta Magnusson's 2018 New York Times best-selling book, The Gentle Art of Swedish Death Cleaning, which inspired the Peacock series, recommends starting in an attic or basement, an area that is bound to contain many items you don't need, like old toys or broken holiday decorations. Once you've determined a category of things you have an abundance of, like clothes or books, you can begin to sort through them without any emotional attachment. 6 tips for successful Swedish death cleaning. Remove excess. Does anyone really need 5 serving platters? 7 sets of matching napkins? What about those roller skates you swore you'd use to exercise? We often hold on to things for their potential or just in case utility, but that only creates clutter. Getting rid of excess items you no longer have a use for is a simple place to start. This step is closest to a Marie Kondo-style decluttering. Go digital. A tedious yet beneficial process, the most streamlined and functional way to hold on to family heirlooms and sentimental photos is to digitize them. Schedule a day to sit down and scan everything from house deeds and medical records to those pre-social media vacation photos from the 1990s. A flash drive is much more manageable than an entire filing cabinet. Discard with intention, not guilt. No matter what you're decluttering, it's easy to feel guilty about creating waste or getting rid of things that are still useful. We're not suggesting that everything go into a landfill. Donate clothes to a charity shop and books to your local library. When you discard items with the intent of making your life and your loved ones' lives easier, the guilt starts to fade. Buy less. Whether you're in your early 20s or early 80s, the simplest way to start Swedish death cleaning is to, well, stop shopping. Buying less doesn't mean cutting back on what you love or enjoy, but it does remind you to think twice before adding that sundress to your cart or buying another throw pillow for your already comfortable bed. Be considerate of others. Let your family members know you're undergoing this process, not as a warning, but as a last call. That way, they can call dibs on anything they'd like to take off your hands now, if you were planning to get rid of it, and speak up if there are items they'd like you to keep, like old art projects or their high school diploma. Take care of yourself. Swedish death cleaning is a marathon, not a sprint. No one is expecting you to declutter your entire life in a single day, week, or even month. Be sure to take breaks, ask for help, and request support from your loved ones. Cleaning and organizing is as mentally draining as it can be physically. But going through your old belongings can actually be fun if you let it. Take joy in the nostalgia and maybe spend some extra time going through photos and recalling memories. Our belongings communicate who we are and what we value. So allow yourself to feel your feelings and reflect on your life, where you've been, and where you have yet to go. From Rolling Stone, she survived the FLDS cult. Now she's healing through music. By Elizabeth Yuko. When Naomi Noms Bistline initially auditioned to be in her prison's band, she tried out to be the guitarist. "Then I started singing a little, and they said, 'Put the guitar down. Let's just hear you sing,'" she says. "I sang Miley Cyrus's song, Flowers, a cappella, and they said, 'We got our lead vocalist.'" Though excited, Bistline, now 27, was apprehensive about performing in front of the other incarcerated women. "I remember that night going back to my cell and thinking, 'This is so scary. I've never done this.' And then coming to the conclusion that I'm the lowest that I've ever been," she says. "I'm the lowest that anyone will be. Nobody has phones to video me and mock me or anything. Like, why not?" At that point, Bistline was in a Texas prison, serving a 21-month sentence for unlawfully removing minors from state custody, a crime she committed under the direction of Sam Bateman. Bateman is the leader of a small offshoot sect of the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, FLDS, who claims to be a prophet and the heir apparent to Warren Jeffs, the FLDS president, who is currently serving life in prison for child sexual assault. Bistline was the 13th of Bateman's 23 spiritual wives, 9 of which were girls as young as 9, and all of whom he sexually abused. After living a sheltered life in a secluded town, followed by a stint in prison, Bistline now finds herself in the public eye, thanks to Netflix's new docuseries, Trust Me, The False Prophet. It tells the story of Christine Marie, PhD, an expert in cult psychology, who infiltrated Bateman's group, posing as a documentary filmmaker, ultimately taking him down, using footage as evidence against him, and the women like Bistline, whom she helped to free. In September 2022, Bateman was arrested following an FBI raid of his Colorado City, Arizona compound, and the minors in his group were placed in state custody. That November, he instructed Bistline and two of his other followers to kidnap the girls and take them out of state. The women were caught in Washington State, arrested, and returned to Arizona. It took a few months of being in prison and away from Bateman for Bistline to realize that he wasn't a prophet and that he had actually been abusing her and the other women and girls. "I started talking to the other inmates, and they'd tell me about their lives," she says. "When I hinted about things that happened in my life, they'd be like, 'Your life was not normal.'" From there, she started challenging her beliefs. "I was also really scared," she explains. I literally thought that if I questioned Sam or Warren Jeffs, then lightning would come in and strike me and kill me. That's how brainwashed I was. Now, 18 months out of prison, Bistlein has turned to making music and studying psychology to gain control over her own life. To see her come into her own is a profound experience, Marie, the filmmaker behind False Prophet, tells Rolling Stone. She's finding her independence and walking her own walk and making her own decisions. It makes me ecstatic. While Bistlein's eyes were opened in prison, many of the women in Bateman's group still believe that he is a prophet and remain devoted to him. I think Sam's group was actually a cult within a cult, Bistlein tells Rolling Stone. After Warren Jeffs took power, the FLDS did turn into a cult, but a lot of the people in it are not bad. They're very, very good people, but they don't know any different. So when Sam came, it was kind of like a break-off of the FLDS. He was still controlling us through Warren Jeffs' trainings. Secular music is still new to Bistlein. Growing up under Jeffs, it was all religious, she says. Our songs were either written by the people in the cult, or they were the FLDS hymns. Today, Bistlein has Olivia Rodrigo, Benson Boone, Bruno Mars, and Lady Gaga on repeat. But she's constantly exposing herself to new genres and musicians. She recently listened to Hole for the first time after Courtney Love commented on one of her Instagram posts. I do love that old music a lot because of the rawness of it, she says of artists from the 1990s. There's no AI stuff, and it's not auto-tuned or anything. It's so refreshing. Music has always been a presence in Bistlein's life. In Bateman's group, we sang every day, but it was all choir singing. Very classic, calm, cult singing, she says. It was still beautiful, though, with amazing harmonies. It was around then she started to write her own songs. Going back and reading those lyrics, it's quite painful to realize how much conflict was going on inside when my heart was hurting all the time, and then my brain was just trying to do everything he said. I didn't understand the pain and suffering and punishments when I was trying my hardest to appease him, do everything he said, become the perfect wife. Though she started on guitar at 13, she was able to practice in prison after one of the unit managers learned that she played the instrument. It was crazy cool and unexpected, but one day he just brought one into me, she says. I started writing more and playing in my cell and just singing. That's when other incarcerated women approached her about being in the prison band. Now Bistlein is working with a vocal coach and making her own music, which she describes as mostly pop, some country. This is a departure from the first songs she wrote while in prison. They were before I'd ever even heard of Billie Eilish, but they had a very Billie Eilish vibe. Sad, melancholy. I wrote songs about my past and forgiving that younger girl, But then I got into these rage anthems when the anger hit. Today, music is a critical part of Bistline's trauma recovery. It's been a release, she says. Whenever I'm getting overstimulated or overwhelmed, I usually just put on music or start singing. It's a go-to and so easy to do. I can do it when I'm doing anything. It's really nice. Bistline is currently working on her first album. The only songs that I have finished are the prison experiences and processing that, and the rage anthems against Sam, she says. She hopes to release her first single and the accompanying music video in the next few weeks. I actually can't wait, because it's been this little secret obsession, she says. But when it's actually out there, and I have something to prove, I think it will be so much better. Though she's still living in Short Creek, an enclave of FLDS families on the Arizona-Utah border, she plans to move out of the area soon. At this point, she hasn't decided where to call home next. I have so many options, she says. Once she earns her degree in psychology from Mojave Community College, Bistline plans to become an advocate for people in cults and coercive relationships. Work she has already started by sharing her story in the docuseries. She did a great service to all of the other victims of Sam Bateman, Marie says. She validated their pain without them having to come forward. And because the response has been so positive, now other victims are realizing they have nothing to be ashamed of. Though watching herself in the series was initially difficult, she's now processing viewers' positive response to the show. I'm still in this space where it's overwhelming, but a relief, because I didn't expect this much support, she says. I was bracing for more pushback, more hate. I felt like everybody has that right to hate me, because I existed in that space, even though I was born and raised in it. In the meantime, amid the music, classes, and self-reflection, Bistline is building herself back one step at a time. I started this diary called My First Time Diary, and I save receipts and tickets and all the different things, and then take pictures and write about those experiences and what I felt about them. Her diary includes a napkin from the first time she ate in a restaurant. She had a tomato sandwich, fries, and orange juice. And the ticket stub from her first trip to a theater. She saw Moana too. I'm still in that era where I say I'm just a baby, she says. I'm only 18 months old. From the New York Times. Instead of a shoot, some couples opt for a booth. Engagement photos in retro strips lend a spontaneous, vintage vibe and cost a lot less. By Gina Chirellis. The day after they became engaged at home last September, Eliza Hodgson and Stephen Wright decided to go out for drinks in Vancouver, British Columbia, to celebrate. The pair, photographers who own a photo and video production agency, thought it would be fun to capture the occasion with images from a vintage photo booth at Slice of Life, an art gallery. The photo booth, for us, is just such a candid and casual way to capture a special moment, Mr. Wright, 38, said, adding that neither of them wanted formal engagement photos. It's very authentic. It's very true to us. And it's a $7 photo strip, Ms. Hodgson, 27, added. The engagement photo shoot has become a rite of passage for many affianced couples. The images costing $200 to $2,000 on average are often used for wedding announcements and invitations. Many photographers, though, include them in wedding packages, according to Zola.com. But more couples are skipping traditional engagement shoots in favor of the photo booth, something more spontaneous that can cost just a few dollars, requires no photographer, and evokes a sense of nostalgia. There are far fewer booths these days. During their heyday from the 1950s through the 1970s, they were common in five and dime stores, bus stations, and amusement parks. But lately, they have been making a comeback in big cities like New York. Instagram and TikTok have been flooded with engagement announcements using candid images from photo booths. Newly engaged pairs are visiting vintage booths and then using the black and white and color strips as the centerpiece of their announcements. Emily Bothello, the operations manager at Auto Photo, a photo booth gallery and museum on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, said she had seen many couples using the booth since the museum opened in October. We have had several spontaneous proposals at our NYC flagship, along with people intentionally hiring out the space for private proposals with friends and family present, Ms. Botello said in an email. As modern digital and technological trends continue to influence weddings, content creators for hire, generative AI for budgeting, couples are taking a pass on the logistical, financial, and social media pressures of planning engagement shoots, reserving that energy instead for the wedding. After her engagement in May, Angel Jefferson, a television writer in Los Angeles, said she and her now husband, Garrett Jefferson, 34, weren't sure how they would announce the news. But Ms. Jefferson had become inspired by people online who had gone to vintage photo booths for other occasions, she said. We're just both super casual people, Ms. Jefferson, 33, said. We barely had a photographer at our wedding. On their first date in December 2024, they met at a bar that had a standing photo booth and took pictures there. After their engagement, they agreed to do the same in a standing photo booth at a coffee shop to bring the experience full circle. The images were $10 for a 4-inch grid, and they did 3 takes. The photos weren't used just to announce their engagement on social media, but also for invitations to their wedding in November and for their wedding website. We got our good use out of that $30, Ms. Jefferson said, especially when you start to think about wedding budgets and numbers. This is the first stop on that train. Let's not blow our load on the first stop here. When Winston Jones, an operations specialist in marketing and a fashion content creator in New York City, was planning to propose to Kayla Navarro, a marketing strategist and photographer, he knew they wouldn't have a traditional engagement shoot. A self-described artsy couple, they already had captured dozens of memories on film during their 6-year relationship, so Mr. Jones wanted to incorporate them into the proposal. My real concern was Kayla's picky about photography, so since she couldn't shoot it herself, I was like, oh God, I don't have enough of the vetting skills to know if they're a good fit, he said. While on a trip in Lisbon for his birthday in October, Mr. Jones, 28, persuaded Ms. Navarro, 29, to stop by a speakeasy for a nightcap before heading back to their hotel. The bar had a photo booth, and the pair eventually squeezed their way inside. That's where he positioned his phone to record the entire proposal. And then he pulls out the ring and is like, "Will you marry me?" she said. I was genuinely very, very surprised. After she said yes, they took what would end up being the photos that they used to tell friends, family, and followers on social media about their nuptials, planned for October 2027. Something we talk about a lot is never giving extravagant portrayals that don't feel real, Ms. Navarro said. I think a lot of couples feel the same way, where they're constantly fed these super high production shoots, and it just feels out of reach. From Good Housekeeping, relationship experts say man-keeping could be one reason women are burned out, by Marissa LaScala. Throughout their long marriage, Hannah Newman of Seattle has handled the couple's social calendar. She makes friends easily and has a lot of them, while her husband is less outgoing and more of a loner. And so she is also his main emotional confidant. When he retired, he was stressed out about transitioning to a life not dominated by work. He needed some friends, but didn't know how to make them. Newman ended up setting him up with the husbands of her book group members. They were looking for a fourth for their weekly pickleball game. She pushed him to accept their overture, and though nervous, he eventually said yes and gained 3 instant new friends. I do sometimes get annoyed when I'm always the one planning things, and I often wish he'd be more receptive or take more interest in our social life, Newman says. But in the grand scheme of things, while frustrating, it isn't a deal-breaker. He is supportive in other ways and handles other responsibilities that I'd rather not tackle. It's a trade-off. If you sometimes feel like Hannah, that you are your husband's or boyfriend's best or maybe only friend, social secretary, and therapist all rolled into one, you may be engaging in man-keeping or managing the social and emotional needs of your male partner. In doing so, you're far from alone. The writer of this article is raising her hand. What the heck is man-keeping? a term coined in 2024 by Angelica Ferrara of Stanford University. Mankeeping refers to the often several hours a week some women dedicate to this usually unrecognized and unreciprocated labor, and it is something a lot of them do without even realizing it, says Bree Temple, chief matchmaker and chief commercial officer of Talkify, one of the nation's largest matchmaking services. They become the planner, the feeler, the fixer, and the emotional manager, she notes. She's the one who remembers everyone's birthdays, keeps his friendships alive, interprets his moods, etc. Mankeeping often involves being the primary and sometimes only emotional sounding board when a male partner feels stressed or overwhelmed. Experts don't necessarily think that mankeeping is increasing, but rather that it is being recognized more. The behavior has been around a long time, but it might feel like it's on the rise because women now have a term and a way to name it, says Dae Kim, an LMFT in Los Angeles. More women are reassessing their relationships and noticing the ongoing work they have done in organizing their male partners' social and emotional lives. As women's own lives have gotten fuller, busier, and harder to manage, says Dr. Suzanne Wallach, a psychotherapist in Los Angeles, the imbalance becomes impossible not to notice. What once felt normal may now feel exhausting to women who want a man who puts in as much emotional energy as they do. Of course, not every man struggles with expressing emotions and developing social relationships, and not every woman is comfortable with sharing feelings or making friends. But of the single women surveyed in 2025 by the Relationship Wellness Institute, 72% indicated that they were tired of emotionally mentoring their male dates. You may be man-keeping if you feel like you are your boyfriend's or husband's social and emotional manager. You may remind him to call his friends or to pick up a Father's Day card. Or you may feel a bit like his therapist, helping him to process his feelings. After the husband of Cleveland's Wynn Nelson spends a night out with his friends, he comes straight to her bedside to give her the full recap. Who said what? Who overshared? Etc. I'm his chosen audience, she says. It's funny and sweet, but it's also a subtle example of man-keeping. I become the processor, the sounding board, the keeper of social context, even in an otherwise healthy, modern relationship. Man-keeping is about how instinctively women become the emotional home base and how rarely we stop to notice we're doing it. Man-keeping can lead to burnout. While it may feel flattering at first to be someone's only confidant, like Nelson above, such a dynamic is usually unsustainable over time. While healthy and appropriate to be the person your boyfriend or husband turns to when they are struggling emotionally, says Sarah Haynes, an LMFT in Denver, I also think it's important that each partner has circles in their life or a source of support to turn to that is outside of the relationship. We can't always be everything for our partner all at once. However, many women don't realize they are man-keeping until they notice they're more tired in the relationship than anywhere else in their life, adds Sonia Bari, a psychotherapist in Bernardsville, New Jersey. What often gets mislabeled as relationship problems is actually burnout from carrying too much of the emotional load, she says. Women often believe something is wrong with the relationship, when what's actually happening is a depletion from carrying too much responsibility for another adult's emotional life. Asia Chavez, LMFT of Long Beach, California, has had both professional and personal experience with this phenomenon. When I found myself being the only person my boyfriend turned to for everything, it felt heavy and I became drained, she says. Every problem at work, every family issue, every decision he needed to make, every feeling he needed to process, it all came to me. The relationship stopped feeling like a partnership and started feeling like another job. What I've learned from my work is that healthy people need more than one person in their lives. They need friends, they need hobbies, and they may need their own therapist. When someone makes their partner their entire world, it's not romantic. It's really a red flag that something's off balance. As the wife of a military member, Marla Bautista of Tampa, Florida, had to ensure that her spouse at all times felt ready for war. His focus had to be on our nation's military mission, not my feelings, she says. After the war in Iraq, I spent many hours explaining his alcoholism or strange behaviors to those who didn't understand the weight of the war. It was burdensome. I was his counselor, PR professional, companion, and sometimes even his mother. The support I gave him didn't bother me until I realized I had lost myself. But by then, it was too late. I gave everything I had, and my cup was empty. The couple divorced after more than 17 years of marriage. Is there hope for such a relationship? A lot of women who end up leaving a relationship like this do not do it because they've stopped loving their partner. They have stopped the relationship because they are exhausted from being the emotional parent of their partner, Temple says. The people who manage to escape this type of relationship and still be with their partner are the ones who are willing to do the emotional work, being honest and calling out the imbalance. This is essentially what turns a draining relationship into a real equal partnership. However, Barry adds, if the imbalance has been clearly named, space has been given for adjustment, and the partner consistently resists taking responsibility for his own emotional life, the issue isn't about effort, it's consent. A relationship can't stay healthy if one person has to overfunction for it to survive. In these instances, say experts, support from a relationship therapist can be very helpful. Tara Wages of Nashville has been married for 17 years, but 8 years into it, she asked her husband for a divorce because she felt lonely and emotionally disconnected from him. There was a long season when my husband was emotionally absent from our relationship, she says. I realize now that it was a coping mechanism. He wasn't taught to navigate his emotions, and he especially wasn't taught how to talk about them. So he stuffed them inside, and they all showed up as anger or absence. Fortunately, her husband stepped up and found the tools to improve the marriage, including therapy and relationship coaching. Having a man who is willing to put effort into a relationship is a sign that you can move through the hard seasons together, Wages says. In my own long-time marriage, I am both my husband's primary, though not only, emotional sounding board, and the manager of our social calendar. I make the dates with other couples, write the thank you notes, make donations in memory of someone's loved ones, buy the birthday and other cards for great Aunt Susie, send out baby gifts, pick up the hostess presents, remind my husband to call the friend who had the knee replacement, etc. I don't mind doing all this. I guess what I miss is the recognition that it really is work that takes time and effort. But like Newman, I see some of this as a trade-off of responsibilities. I'd rather make our social plans and offer my husband emotional support than balance our checkbook or oversee house repairs, two tasks he does without my support. And I do see signs that the younger generations are working to balance this issue in their relationships. I love getting a thank you note or text written by the groom or new father whose wife has her own busy life, especially if he's the one I watched grow up. Understand that initiative for your partner can also look like becoming more involved in their community or reaching out to a friend that they haven't talked to in a while. Small but consistent efforts can have a big payoff in helping to equalize this dynamic. And that brings us to the end of the program. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. And please join me again for the Women's Hour.
This is Bird Note. I'm Marcus Roston, a naturalist and birder in Buffalo, New York, where I love watching American herring gulls. One of my favorite places to find them is Freedom Park, a migration crossroads for birds and people. This was once a final stop on the Underground Railroad, where freedom seekers crossed the Niagara River to safety. Gulls take refuge at the park year-round. Herring gulls may seem unremarkable, especially in winter when young birds all look the same in mottled shades of brown and black, but I feel my brown skin crawl when people call them rats with wings. It makes me think about who gets labeled a nuisance and who gets praised, whose features are admired and whose are disparaged. When we dismiss these birds as rats with wings, we miss something important. Though American herring gulls may seem common now, their populations are actually in steep decline. Watching the gulls at Freedom Park, I see a lesson in resilience and a reminder that there's beauty in shades of brown and black. This is Black Birders Week. To learn more, follow the hashtag Black Birders Week on social media and visit birdnote.org. I'm Marcus Roston.
Hi, my name's Owen Devlin, and this is my story. When my doctor told me I was losing my vision, I was devastated. I worried about my future. How would I attend college, find a great job, start a family, or even travel around my own neighborhood? Luckily, my doctor also told me about the Mass Commission for the Blind. They connected me and my family to a counselor who helped us to set a vision for my future, one that included assistive technology to allow me to go to school and find a meaningful job, a white cane to help me navigate, and even tips on how to use Google Maps on my mobile phone. I found out that losing my vision wasn't the end of the world.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.